Welcome to the ISF podcast from the Information Security Forum, featuring timely conversations, practical insights, and resources for global cybersecurity professionals. I'm your host, Tavia Gilbert. This season, we hear from the guest speakers from ISF's 2021 Digital Congress. Today, ISF CEO Steve Durbin is in conversation with Dr. Brian Cox, a professor of particle physics at the University of Manchester. Dr. Cox has co-written several books on physics, including Why Doesn't E Equal MC Squared? And The Quantum Universe, and has also appeared in many science programs for BBC radio and television, including in Einstein's Shadow and the BBC Horizon series. He and Steve discuss how to translate a complex message to a lay audience, the need for intellectual honesty, and the value of play, even in serious endeavors.
Brian, thanks very much for joining me on the podcast. You spoke recently at the ISF Digital 2021 Congress, and certainly our members were fascinated by some of the areas that you covered there. You talked about black holes, you talked about all sorts of things that I think were really mind-boggling for most people. And the feedback has been absolutely excellent from our members, so thank you very much for doing that.
Pleasure.
You're known, and in fact you've won awards, for translating, you know, complex scientific ideas, as you did for us at the Congress, to a lay audience and really getting them excited about science, bringing all of that to life. Most of our podcast listeners are security professionals. They often have to communicate complex, some would say esoteric concepts, ideas to boards and colleagues within their own organizations. And sometimes those people don't necessarily speak the same language, if you see what I mean. So I'm curious, what insights do you think you could offer up to the security professional that would help them to get some of those, you know, complex ideas across in a way that is engaging, very much like you did for us just in October?
Well, thank you for saying that. I think the key thing, which should go without saying but doesn't necessarily, is you have to understand what you're talking about very deeply.
Right.
And I think that sounds like a ridiculous thing to say, but I don't think it is. I find that when we're talking about, I was talking about relativity, which is, in some sense, you know, it's got a reputation for being arcane. But I teach the basics, so-called special relativity, at University of Manchester,
right,
to first years. It's one of the first courses that they do when they come in at 18 years old after A-level. And I find that I get a deeper insight into it pretty much every year. And so I think a key thing is not to kid yourself that you understand something at a deep level.
Right.
Because, I mean, I honestly find that I'm quite slow quite often at picking up concepts because I really want to convince myself that I have a deep understanding of the concept. And I think once you've done that and gone through that process yourself, then it becomes easier to communicate it because you've gone through the, you started out as that person who knew nothing about it.
Right.
And so I suppose another tip would be to remember that you started out as that person that didn't understand it and remember those steps that you went through,
right,
to get some kind of a deeper understanding of the subject.
Tough though, isn't it? Particularly for some people who might be listening to this, you think, well, you know, I'm supposed to be the expert. You know, people are sort of coming to me and yet here's Brian telling me to dumb it down effectively.
Well, no, I mean, I think there's an honesty in my talk actually that you referred to. I mentioned Richard Feynman, who's one of my great heroes, won the Nobel Prize for something called quantum electrodynamics.
Right.
A very interesting career, also worked on the Manhattan Project, as many physicists did in the 40s. And he said that you can fool yourself very easily. You're a very easy thing to fool. So you can fool yourself into thinking that you have a deep understanding of it. And that word expert, I think, can be, if you consider yourself to be an expert, I think you may have a problem immediately, actually, because, you know, I don't. And, you know, the best physicists that I know will certainly, one of the skills that you learn is to know when your understanding stops and when you begin to become shaky. And in physics, it can often manifest itself in falling back on mathematics.
Right.
So you can often say, oh, well, no, it's in the equation, though. But actually, I think if you can't vocalize what that mathematics or that model is telling you, it really is a signal that you don't understand it at a deep level.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know that, you know, in all our professions, we all use models, we all use data sets. And I think if you find yourself giving a presentation and falling back on jargon, are going, well, look, it's obviously in the graph or whatever, or it's in the data somewhere. That's probably a warning sign, I think, that you've not really internalised what you're talking about because you can't vocalise it.
Right. So it's about self-awareness as well, isn't it? It's about, you know, self-awareness, understanding the audience, and I would say putting yourself in the audience's shoes to really try to get some of that message across.
Yeah, yeah. And I think I find the most, when I started doing television, that the most difficult person, the most difficult people to speak to are your colleagues. You know, so if you look at a camera and you see your colleagues down it, or your manager or whatever, someone that you think, you know, is expecting you to know everything and be the expert, then it's extremely difficult, in my experience, to be clear and to be smooth and to be comprehensible. Because you try to, certainly for me, something happens in your mind that you think I've got to show that I'm authoritative. Mm-hmm. And you're not trying to show that you're authoritative. You might be with clients, I suppose, but with colleagues, you're not. You're trying to impart a deep understanding of a problem. And also, as I say, the more that you go through it, the more you try and teach it, the more you try and discuss it, the deeper your understanding becomes, your personal understanding.
Much of what security is all about today is, and increasingly will be, I think, is how we manage risk, how we measure it, how we try to make decisions based on perhaps our own or organisation's risk appetite. What do you think we can learn from science and scientific models that can help us in that process of risk management?
I mean, again, from my perspective, it's the theme of honesty, intellectual honesty. I know that, for example, in engineering, particularly in engineering, so aviation engineering, for example, then it's honesty is the key. I remember once I was at a dinner with someone in the Royal Navy who was head of safety in nuclear submarines, so very high up in the safety hierarchy of nuclear submarines. And he said that one of the things they try to avoid is checklist-itis, where you go through the checklist and you go, that's okay, that's okay, that's okay. It was about taking responsibility for looking at a problem. In that case, a big problem, is this nuclear warhead safe?
Right.
and say, no, I have to convince myself. Even if there's something not quite right, even if it's not on the checklist. And so it's about, I think, being honest if you don't know. I mean, clearly, you know, people in your industry know this, not covering up issues or brushing them under the carpet because you're not quite sure about them. And I suppose I'm probably saying something that everything who's listening to this podcast understands. But I think it is quite hard. In science, in my research area, particle physics, we deal with huge data sets. And so a huge number of statistics, as we say, lots and lots, billions of particle collisions. And it's very easy to see signals for new physics, new particles and things in an enormous data set because you've got fluctuations all over the place, so little statistical peaks will emerge in the data and you can get very excited. And so there's a framework to keep you honest, which is we have a very high level of what we would term to be a discovery or an observation. So it really is like flipping a coin 100 times and it would have to come up 90 times heads before you claim that there's anything wrong with the coin. You know, it's not 51, but 90.
Right.
And so that you learn, I think, when you have big data sets, and many of your people who are listening will know this, but you learn to get a sense for just having a hint of something interesting, or indeed a hint of something going right, is not enough. You've got to be absolutely convinced. And it's almost going above and beyond your instinct, I think. You know, I mean, I've made 10 Nobel Prize winning discoveries and all 10 proved to be statistical fluctuations, ultimately, you know. And many scientists will have that experience.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because one of the debates that's ongoing in the security industry at the moment, particularly around risk, is whether quantifying risk is better than a qualitative approach to it. Now, I tend to sit in the middle of that. I'm pretty much on the fence because I believe that both have a role to play. But you do have, as in most industries, you know, zealots who sit on either side. Now, you talk about instinct. You talk about the combination of instinct plus science. Is one better than the other, do you think, for what we're trying to do?
There's a wonderful set of BBC Reith lectures I would recommend to everybody. The transcripts are available online, and it's Robert Oppenheimer, who most famous for the Manhattan Project.
Right.
I think they were called Science and the Common Understanding. And he said, in terms of what you said about there are zealots on either side, he said it's very important to understand that both of them will be right and both of them will be wrong. Actually, the truth is some kind of what we call a linear combination of the two in physics. So it'll be some mixture.
A compromise to the rest of us.
Well, no, I don't think it is. I think it's, for example, he cited the example of subatomic particles. Mm-hmm. So he said an electron, what is it? It can be a little point-like thing. You can consider it as a little grain of sand, which is perhaps how many of us think about particles. But also you can think of it as an extended wavy thing that fills any region in which it's placed. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's a wavy thing or it's a point-like thing. What is it? It's neither and both. It's actually some kind of combination of the two that more than the sum of its parts. It behaves differently in different situations. But you need both of those pictures in order to get a deep understanding of what this thing is. Mm-hmm. So it's not a compromise to say, you hear it in quantum mechanics, a lot of you read popular science books, you see, you know, some wave particle duality, it's sometimes a wavy particle thing. This is not compromise language to go, well, it's sort of some a bit of that and a bit of that. It's actually the way nature is.
Right.
And his point was that one of the key transferable skills in science, which goes all the way back to school, actually, in school science experiments, is that you learn that sometimes apparently mutually contradictory ideas are both valid, right? And you've got to hold them in your head at the same time. So just as you said, I don't think it's a compromise to say, well, there are two main approaches, mm-hmm. and I sit somewhere in the middle. Oppenheimer would say that's a deep wisdom because you're actually getting a much deeper picture of the reality of the situation.
So that's worth everybody remembering, isn't it? That particular point, you know, it's a deeper wisdom. So if anybody's questioned from a security standpoint about, you know, why aren't you coming down on one side or the other, then it is about referring back to that, because that is part of the process, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know about the specifics you're talking about, but I think I get the sense that you would agree that sometimes it's more useful to think in this particular way, and sometimes it's more useful to think in that particular way. And broadly speaking, it's good to have both those tools at your disposal.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think that is what actually boards, the business side of most organisations, are actually looking for. It's this balanced argument, the balanced discussion that gives them all of the information from which they can then make a decision.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that nature really does force you to think like that, because nobody expected that. I don't think anybody expected that particles would be anything other than little point-like things, like little grains of sand. The idea that you send an electron along, there's a very famous thing called the two-slit experiment, which you can imagine water waves going out on the surface of a pond and put two little slits in the way, two little apertures through which they can travel. And you get this thing called an interference pattern. Mm-hmm. And you may have seen it, and you could see it in your bath, actually. You can see waves interfere with each other, because sometimes there's a peak and sometimes there's a trough, and they'll cancel out. So we're familiar with that with waves. Well, electrons behave in the same way. That was an experimental observation. It was suspected they might, but ultimately it's an experimental observation. And then you've got to explain it. Mm-hmm. And so what do you do? Immediately you've got this challenge from nature that says this thing is not a point-like object. It doesn't matter what your Feynman again. It doesn't matter what your opinion is. It doesn't matter what your name is or what your title is or how important you are. If your opinion disagrees with nature, you are wrong. And that lesson is, I think, vitally important. It doesn't matter what your position is in the company or the hierarchy. You can actually be objectively wrong. Mm-hmm. And it's not a bad thing either. The way that we make progress in understanding nature is being wrong is in some sense, is as good as being right, but you're never right in physics. I don't think we have any, in fact, we don't have any fundamental theory that we think is actually correct at a deep level. We have a series of models which are more accurate representations of the way that nature works, but none of them are considered to be absolutely correct.
That's interesting, if I think about that then from the security standpoint, because I think that one of the things that, because security is really still relatively young industry, relatively immature, and I think that if I look at the way that it's evolved, we've started by having process, we tried to define rules, we believed that there was a black and white. But increasingly, of course, there isn't. Because if you look at the majority of attacks that take place, what's the weak point? Well, the weak point, in the most cases, is us. It's you and I, it's people. Mm. Because we're behaving in ways that don't conform to a black and white environment. You know, we're grey. And so it is interesting, I think, that we're having to shift some of our ideas, some of our approaches, in much of the way that you've just been talking about.
Yeah. The science is ultimately based on data, on observations, on experiments. There are exceptions where the theory leads the experiment. And actually, what I talked about primarily in my talk was Einstein's theory of general relativity. And that's one of the exceptions, I think. There was virtually no data. I think Einstein would have said there was nothing that had been observed to say that a new theory of gravity was necessary, specifically. So we had this beautiful theory that Newton wrote down in 1687, which worked. And everything that had been seen, every gravitational phenomena that had been observed, was beautifully described by that model. Now, Einstein really built a new model on aesthetic grounds initially. And that's very rare. Usually there's a challenge from nature. Mm-hmm. But we found that this theory, this thing that was built on really an aesthetic sense, instinct almost by Einstein, ended up being the framework within which we describe the evolution of the universe and the existence of black holes. It's a remarkable thing. I think there's a lesson here. He built it by thinking about the simplest thing. I think it's true. Sometimes these things are apocryphal, but he did say that he was watching someone working on a roof across from his apartment. And he thought, if that person falls off the roof, then on the way down, they won't be concerned about gravity at all, in the sense that they won't feel it.
Right.
They're free of gravity. I mean, obviously, they hit the ground and then they're concerned. Yep. But today, we're very familiar with that because that's the situation in the space station. Mm-hmm. So we're used to seeing astronauts floating around, as we call them, weightless. And what's happening is they're in free fall, they're falling. And the fundamental observation is that everything falls at the same rate in a gravitational field. So if you're an astronaut in a space station and you have a screwdriver and you let go of it, it just stays there. Mm-hmm. They're both falling towards the Earth. They're both falling at the same rate. Now, Einstein's great insight, this is why he's a genius, was to say, it's not as if gravity is gone. It's gone. In free fall, there isn't any. It's
right.
Disappeared. And that was the key that led into this geometric picture of gravity as the curvature and warping of the fabric of the universe itself. So there is no force in Einstein's theory between things. Mm-hmm. As you know, Newton would say, you know, the apple fell and hit me on the head because of the force between the apple and the earth, and it pulls it down. In Einstein's theory, actually, technically, the view is Newton accelerated up to headbutt the apple. It's completely the opposite. But essentially, there's no force there.
Right.
It's we're experiencing now, as we sit on this chair, we're experiencing the warping of the fabric of the universe and not some force that's pulling us down to the ground. But that all led from this simplest idea, that just thinking about what falling is and why does gravity seem to have gone? Maybe it has. Maybe it's gone. And off you go.
So I think, again, from a security standpoint, my sort of takeaway from that particular story would be to continue to question, not just accept that the way that you've done things in the past is the way that you ought to do things in the future.
Yeah.
Because it may be absolutely fine, but it may also not be. And that may be preventing you from getting some extra insight that could move things along.
Yeah, and I suppose the analogy is good in the security industry because Einstein didn't wait until something went wrong with the other theory.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's very rare, as I say, in science. Usually you have an observation that contradicts your theory, which is great in science. I suppose it's not so great in your industry. That means somebody's hacked something.
Well, that's right.
Yeah. Missed something. So I suppose that idea that there may be better ways to do things even when you don't have to find them. Interestingly, at my university, the University of Manchester, we're talking about R&D. And there's always a tension between, in government funding as well, between directed R&D and what we call blue skies R&D.
Right.
And the boundary is very blurred, actually. But there's a colleague of mine, André Geim, who got the Nobel Prize for discovering graphene. And he, in his Nobel speech, pointed out that he did that in his Friday afternoon sessions, which were the free sessions. So he was insistent that as part of your job, there should be a time when you are free to roam and is free to explore anything that you feel like exploring. And there's very good examples of that throughout R&D and the history of science where people are playing around. So playing around, I think, is really important. It certainly has been in science. So it's serendipity is an important component of discovery. And I suppose in your industry, I would guess that it's very difficult to do, of course, in a commercial yeah. context, but I would guess that playing around and not, I suppose I'll go back to that point, it just occurred to me that if you wait in the security industry until there's an imperative, until something, what you're saying is you're waiting until something goes wrong, aren't you? Mm. But the way to not think like that is to somehow have that ability to play around in your R&D time.
Yeah.
And that's what he did. He did it with the pencil. He was playing around with sellotape and a pencil lead. And he ended up discovering this two-dimensional carbon structure called graphene, which is, you know, we've only begun to scratch the surface of how useful it is. Mm. Multi-billion dollar industry now. But it came from someone playing around in Manchester on a Friday afternoon. He's the only person, I think, in history to have won the Ig Nobel Prize and the Nobel Prize.
Oh, is that
so
right?
The Ig Nobel Prize is the silly one.
Right.
And he got that for levitating frogs, which he was also doing, which led nowhere. I don't think, as far as I know, anyway. But the graphene, was, yeah, worked.
Brian's been fascinating talking to you and drawing some of these analogies between obviously your world and the world of security. So thank you very much indeed for taking the time to do that. It's been an absolute pleasure. Professor Brian Cox, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to this week's guest, Dr. Brian Cox. Next week, Steve sits down with Dr. Sadie Kreese, a professor of cybersecurity at Oxford University. Here's a preview of that conversation.
I find it hard to imagine a really successful business in 10 years with the level of dependency we have on tech, made, as you said, more acute by the pandemic, and that we won't be rewinding that.
No, absolutely.
It's impossible that people won't have thought about this. I know different organisations will do it to different degrees, but it's just impossible to imagine a successful company that doesn't have some ability to even procure some cyber risk advice. So mm-hmm. this is what this is about. Leaders need to know when to ask for help, how much they need to know, when they need people's staff in the company knowing it, when they can subcontract it, what kinds of support team they need, who's on the payroll, who's not, who's a non-exec, who's got to be actually on the exec, and how to evolve that.
We'll be back for the full conversation in a week. In the meantime, is there a topic or question that you'd like us to cover in a future episode? Let us know at securityforum.org, which is also where you can find the catalog of past video and podcast episodes, as well as ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance related to discussions like today's. Find us on LinkedIn by searching CEO Steve Durbin or Security Forum. Follow our audio feed wherever you get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode. And if you like the ISF podcast, we'd love it if you'd write a short review. The ISF podcast is produced by Talkbox and Tavia Gilbert, with music by Alexander Filipiak, associate producer Katie Flood, mix and master by Brian Barney. Thanks for listening.